Part 4.
Chapter 10. Back to Work. For a while, all Mulla Cable could do was play video games, morning, noon, and night. It was January 2002, and while it would be some years before hope would erode from villages like Hilaz, Mulla Cable had already lost faith in the future. It had been nearly 2 months since his ignominious retreat from Afghanistan, and he had hardly a clue what to do next. He and his family were living in a cramped cinderblock apartment with relatives in a working-class neighborhood of Karachi, Pakistan. He hated everything about the city. It was too big, too noisy, too crowded. The food was too spicy, and you couldn't trust anyone. Not long after his arrival, a Pakistani businessman had used a phony marketing scheme to swindle Mulla Cable out of a significant portion of the money he'd brought from Kabul. Some days later, he was robbed in a restaurant. At first, he had ventured out daily in search of work, but it was hard enough for Pakistanis to find jobs, let alone illegal Afghan immigrants. So he abandoned his quest, and for days on end, he would retreat to an arcade parlor, playing virtual pinball and chatting up the Afghan owner. Life was now a matter of keeping down the past. Mulla Cable was no more. Indeed, if he could have had his way, Mulla Cable would have never existed. There was only Akbar Gul, and he told everyone that the previous 5 years were a diversion, merely a job that had to be done, a job he hadn't put much thought into. Privately, however, the bitterness clung to him. It was impossible to forgive the Taliban, Mulla Omar, all those who had left him in the lurch. He couldn't shake off this rancor, so he learned to live with it, fixing his mind on the days ahead. Those were months of one job or get-quick-rich scheme after another. The nadir came when he opened up a delivery service with an acquaintance, and his partner absconded with the startup funds. The truth was, you simply couldn't make ends meet in Pakistan. Not honestly. Not if you didn't know someone. Iran, on the other hand? Now there was a country. Akbar Gul had heard about it since boyhood, and it had always been the plan to get there, somehow. Now the war was over, and he knew that the time was right to make the trip. Borrowing money from a cousin, he paid for a smuggler escort and was guided with other migrant workers through the hot, open country of the Pakistani-Iranian border. They came to Shiraz, a towering city, bright and clean like nothing he'd ever seen. Every morning, he showed up at the muster zone and sometimes found a day's work at a marble factory. Always gifted with his hands, he now put them to good use, making marble figurines for rich collectors in Tehran and further afield. He was a quick study, and in short order was promoted to full-time employment. Soon enough, however, Iranian authorities swept through the industrial zone to clamp down on illegal immigrants. Akbar Gul ended up hiding in a migrant camp on the city's outskirts. The spring months came and he continued to pick up occasional employment, sculpting figurines, sending the earnings back to his wife and daughter in Pakistan. But the work was never steady, and he was left with ample time to think. Some evenings, he stood across from the mall, watching the lights and the gleaming new cars and the men and women with their children. There were days when he went to the ice cream parlor, not for the ice cream, but just for a look. At nighttime in bed, in a shared room at the migrant camp, he would think back to Afghanistan, longing to be among his people, to hear Pashto spoken in the streets. He missed the food, the hospitality, the mountain air. He wanted to be near his family again. It was true that folks back home could never even dream of the sort of life Iranians enjoyed, with their trains and glass buildings and grand multi-lane highways. But what good was it all if you could be locked up or deported at a moment's notice? That summer, he was listening to the radio when he caught a voice speaking Farsi with an Afghan accent. It was President Karzai. All refugees should return immediately, the president urged, to help rebuild their country. It was exactly what Akbar Gul was waiting for. That very night, he arranged to leave for Pakistan to collect his wife and daughter. This time, he told himself, he wouldn't make the same mistakes. He would follow his brother's footsteps. He'd get a job, maybe join the police force. It would be a new beginning, a quiet life. When Akbar Gul and his family stepped out of the taxi in Kabul on a bone-dry, dead-hot August day in 2002, he hardly recognized the city he'd left behind 9 months earlier. It was a place reborn. There were returnees everywhere, living up in the mountains, around town, or squatting in abandoned homes. At an intersection, he saw a man in a pressed uniform and white hat directing traffic, as cars flooded in from all directions. There were schoolgirls and bicyclists jockeying for space on the sidewalk, and vendors selling music openly on the streets. That very day, he picked up a cassette player. With money saved up from Iran, he rented a small apartment at the edge of town. In a corner of one room, he placed his other new acquisition, a television set. Over the weeks that followed, he reconnected with his old comrades, all of whom, like him, were settling into civilian life. Early one morning, he walked through downtown to a narrow street with low red-painted cement walls and came to a large gated entrance. It was the Ministry of the Interior. A line of people had already formed, spilling out into the street, and a pair of men in pakols, carrying Kalashnikovs, stood watch. Akbar Gul sat down along the wall with the others. An hour passed, and then a second. The waiting men pooled money together and bought some Bolani turnovers, which they parceled out among themselves and ate. A third hour passed, and still no one came out to address the line. Word was that only a few men would get interviews on any day. Finally, a man in a white-topped visor hat appeared and announced that they would not be taking inquiries today, but that people should come back the next morning. Akbar Gul walked home, caked in dust from the broken asphalt roads. He returned every day, and it took him a good week to make it into the waiting room. Applicants and police officers crowded in together, and he stood there for hours. A picture of Ahmad Shah Massoud hung on the wall, under it the words, National Hero of Afghanistan. He came back for weeks more, but the waiting room was the farthest he got. The problem was that he didn't know anyone in the ministry, and without access, you were out of luck. He tried other government agencies, construction firms, even aid organizations, but the story was always the same. "The situation became very bad," he recalled. "We had nothing. I came home one day and saw my daughter sleeping on a flour sack. There was no carpet or anything else. She was just on the ground." As the last of his Iran savings dried up, he started collecting old bread discarded from the bakery and soaking it in water for dinner, just as he had during the Civil War. Returning refugees were pouring into Kabul, in part because so many had lost claims on their land out in the provinces. During the war years, squatters or warlords had occupied the vacant land, and without documentation, it was impossible to prove ownership. Akbar Gul was more fortunate. Relatives had stayed behind in his ancestral home of Wardak province to guard the family property. They owned a plot of good soil, a small section of which had been apportioned to him. It had always been his intention to hold on to it for old age, but it was now clear that he would have to sell it, or at least part of it, just to survive the winter. The property lay adjacent to his father's house, which had been empty for the better part of a decade. So in late September 2002, Akbar Gul and his family packed up their possessions once again and relocated to Wardak province. Their new home, in Chak district, was only 50 miles from Kabul, yet it couldn't have seemed more remote. The village was perched on a broad gravel hill overlooking sagebrush slopes, and down in the valley below were wheat farms and apple orchards, with small houses amid them, like tiny mud castles. The water that fed the soil was itself the color of mud, as was the road running across the valley to the bazaar. The mud-splattered shops there were converted shipping containers, with felt mats or tarpaulins covering their entrances. They all sat in the shadow of a gargantuan dam, which in better times had provided electricity for Kabul, but had by now fallen into disrepair, its waters muddy and still. After selling a portion of his land, Akbar Gul finally felt himself again. His daughter was eating, and he even had enough money left over to purchase a used station wagon, which he planned to put into use as a taxi. The winter came and went, and he busied himself meeting people around the village. His life was now made up of mornings chatting up shopkeepers in the bazaar, lunches of rice and naan, afternoons in slumber, and evenings back at the bazaar. For the first time since Iran, he had money to spare, and he took to making improvements to the house. It gradually occurred to him that his worst fears about the Taliban collapse had not been realized. Maybe the coming of the Americans wasn't so bad after all. Maybe it was exactly what his people needed. Help, stability, a chance for a decent life. Sure, there were problems. The Northern Alliance seemed to control everything, leaving Pashtuns like him impotent. But what country didn't have issues? Certainly this was better than what he'd suffered in Pakistan and Iran. The trouble was, he needed to keep himself busy. Village life moved slowly, and a man with Akbar Gul's tastes couldn't keep still for long. Casting an entrepreneurial eye around the village, he saw opportunity everywhere. At the bazaar, he would poke his head in at one shop after another, in no time assuming the role of occasional butcher, tire salesman, or grocery vendor as he filled in for his new friends. He spent most evenings behind the counter at an electronic goods stall, which sold everything from hand-cranked radios and flashlights to the newest addition to village life, the cell phone. He was there one day when a young man strolled up holding a broken phone. "Can you fix this?" he asked. The phone wasn't turning on, even when fully charged. "I don't know," Akbar Gul said, turning it over. In fact, he hadn't the faintest idea how such a machine worked. The man said he'd pay whatever it took. Never one to refuse a challenge, Akbar Gul agreed to take a look and told the man to return in a few days. He wasn't sure why he did things like this. It usually just landed him in trouble. But he couldn't help himself. He pried the phone open with a screwdriver and stared at the circuit board, with its strange knobs and pathways and wires. "There has to be a logic to it. It doesn't run on magic," he told himself. He thought back to the automobiles he had retooled on the front lines. This couldn't be that different. Yet it was. Everything was tiny, and you couldn't simply pull parts out. Or could you? He followed the pathways to a flat square with miniature wires emanating from its side like some sort of strange centipede. He took his screwdriver and slid the tip under the square. Suddenly, it snapped. Akbar Gul stared at what he'd done. It had come clean off the board. He tried to fit it back on, in the process mangling two wires. Struggling to fix those, he damaged others. In the end, the phone appeared beyond repair. He jumped into his car and drove an hour to Kabul. At the electronics bazaar there, his fears were confirmed. The phone was ruined. There was only one way out of this. On the spot, he purchased a phone of the same model and then replaced the damaged interior with a new one. The next day, when the man found his phone working as good as new, he was stunned. "You're a genius!" he exclaimed. "I've been everywhere! No one could fix this!" Akbar Gul beamed triumphantly. Over the next few days, as news of Akbar Gul's cell phone prowess spread, more villagers showed up with broken phones. With a reputation to uphold, he couldn't turn them down. He tinkered with each phone until it broke, then drove to Kabul and replaced it with a brand new one. Within days, he earned renown across chalk as a cell phone wizard. "It wasn't a very profitable business," he admitted to me. He began avoiding the bazaar, but the customers always found him. With each phone he ruined, however, he learned something new about the way they worked. Eventually, he found that he had to rush to Kabul less often. In time, he became something of a genuine cell phone expert, or at least more expert than anyone in the nearby countryside. Borrowing money from friends, he erected a stall of his own and began fixing phones. Akbar Gul had finally found his métier. He started visiting electronics bazaars in Kabul to study the latest imports. There was so much to discover. In the newest phones, you could store snippets of songs as ringtones. Some could even play video clips. When he introduced these innovations in the village, they proved to be a big hit. People came with their favorite Pashtun tunes and Bollywood numbers, and he installed them for a modest fee. By the summer's end, he had amassed a small fortune by village standards. It had been a year since his arrival in Wardak province, and Mullah Cable was now known everywhere in Chalk as Mobile Phone Akbar Gul. Even customers from neighboring districts sought him out. He abandoned his plans to run a taxi business and decided that he would branch out into radios and televisions. The latter hadn't made it into the village yet, but they were spreading rapidly through Kabul, and he knew that it would only be a matter of time. It was high noon and the earth baked and the bazaar was shutting down for sleep when a pair of men showed up at the shop. They both wore neat blue-gray uniforms with Afghan flag patches on their lapels. One of them handed a phone to Akbar Gul and ordered him to fix it. He had long feared this day would come. These were members of the brand-new Afghan National Police, and they descended like hungry dogs on anyone making good money. "You'll need to pay like everyone else," Akbar Gul said. Soon they were in a shouting match. It ended with the officer raising his hand and striking Akbar Gul hard. The other one kicked over the stand. Then they walked away, leaving Akbar Gul standing there, dazed. He watched them get into their police truck, kick up dust, and drive away. That Friday at the mosque after prayers, the shopkeepers gathered around bowls of fruit and swapped stories, and Akbar Gul recounted what had happened. The men nodded and told their own tales. Everyone agreed that the police chief and the district council and the governor himself were in on the racket. They traded stories from around the province of police checkpoints that would rob you dry, and of officials in Kabul who would do nothing about it. They spoke of the Taliban's collapse, and how locally elected councils had initially functioned as the replacement government until the Northern Alliance marched in and took over. A power struggle had ensued, with the alliance commanders labeling their opponents as Taliban to secure their elimination by the Americans. It was common knowledge that the men now controlling Wardak had grisly records. The police chief, for one, was a member of the Sayyaf militia, the same group that had participated in the massacre of Hazaras in Kabul during the Civil War. But the most damning fact about the new police force, the thing that angered the shopkeepers the most, was that it actually wasn't new at all. It was simply an amalgamation of old militias and gangs. In Wardak's multi-party, multi-ethnic district of Jalrez, for instance, all 65 members of the police force hailed from a single pro-Sayyaf village. Akbar Gul had heard some of these stories before, but had never paid them much attention until now. When the police showed up at the bazaar a few days later asking for a tax, he thought back to his friend's stories and paid without complaint. It was clear that refusing to pay would get him beaten or jailed, or worse, delivered to the Americans as a member of Al-Qaeda. It was not long before the police started showing up at the bazaar every week or so to collect their tax. But even then, they were not satisfied. Sometimes they would forcibly enter homes and help themselves to whatever they desired. Once they broke into a house, not far from Akbar Gul's, and robbed a newly married couple at gunpoint of the equivalent of $50,000. The precinct headquarters became drug trade central, and most of the time, the police themselves seemed high. The biggest shock came when the police raided Carla Schefter's clinic. A 60-year-old German nurse, Schefter had been running her humanitarian medical facility for more than a decade to everyone's approval. The police, however, stormed the clinic in an ostensible search for criminals and made off with thousands of dollars worth of equipment. "It depressed me," Akbar Gul recalled. "What did she ever do to anyone? She only helped us." A few weeks later, a female neighbor who had left her house without permission was abducted and raped. Although everyone knew that the police were responsible, nothing could be done. The victim later committed suicide to restore her family's honor. That autumn, the police kidnapped a young boy and took him to the mountains, where they gang-raped him and left him to die. It was not long after these incidents that Akbar Gul received a call from Abbas, an old friend from the Taliban days.
"You know the situation," Abbas said. "What do you want to do about it?"
Akbar Gul certainly knew the situation. By now, everyone did. In addition to the news from his district, stories were flooding in from around the country. People were being taken away by helicopters during the night and never seen again, and there was not a law on earth to protect them. Tribal elders were being sent to Guantanamo. Guns and money were ruling the land.
Of course I know, but what can I do?
We've started work. You interested?
Work. So that was what they called it. Around the country, he knew, incidents were cropping up here and there. The odd shooting of a policeman, or a bomb buried in a road, detonating when an American vehicle passed over. They were few, but noticeable. Akbar Gul was surprised that his former comrades were actually contemplating fighting. No matter how bad things were getting, he felt in his bones that there had been enough bloodshed. Now it was embarrassing even to admit that he had once been in the Taliban, and friends knew that it was a subject you didn't bring up in his presence. Undeniably, the Americans and the police seemed to be no alternative. But could anyone actually take on the United States? The thought seemed absurd. He would never forget the bombing up in the mountains, or his trek through the forests of Waziristan.
No, Akbar Gul replied. Look, I've got my shop. I have a family.
Abbas insisted that the time was now, and Akbar Gul countered that the movement was over, and for good reason.
I'm done fighting, he said, and I think life will get better. We just need to be patient.
For many Taliban members who had abandoned the movement, however, life was turning out to be more complicated than anyone anticipated. Mohammed Haqqani, a former Taliban deputy minister who had fled to Pakistan during the American bombing, later recalled those initial post-Taliban years to a reporter.
When I was visiting my daughter one night, she asked me about our Kabul home, why we didn't have a car anymore. She complained that it was too hot in the refugee camp, and that she wanted to move back to the cool climate of Kabul. I couldn't answer her, but she could tell from my eyes how sad I was. I was a wreck, nervous, worried, and almost panic-stricken.
Under such duress, it didn't take long for Taliban leaders to flock to the proverbial bargaining table, hoping to cut deals with the new government. It was a replay in their minds of their own rise to power, when they had struck accords with anyone willing to submit to their authority.
We expected that if we offered no resistance, they would accept us, and we could live in peace,
said former Minister of Defense Mullah Obaidullah, one of the movement's most senior figures. Obaidullah, a confidant of Supreme Leader Mullah Omar, attempted multiple times to engineer deals with the new authorities. In January 2002, he contacted Kandahar Governor Gul Agha Sherzai with a compelling offer. In return for amnesty, he would pledge loyalty to the Karzai government, forswear political life, and submit to regular government monitoring. Joining him were six other leading Taliban officials, including the notorious one-eyed, one-legged Mullah Turabi, who as Minister of Justice and head of the religious police, had been a zealot's zealot, an architect of edicts outlawing everything from kite flying to music. The group now accepted the U.S.-backed government's legitimacy, and after Sherzai signed off on the deal, retired quietly to their home villages.
They plan to take up a life of preaching, just like they did after the Russians left, reported Ahmed Shah Chekzai, a lawmaker who visited them at the time.
The Obaidullah group and the three top Taliban officials who went to Khasr Uzgan in January 2002 in search of a pact, only to be stymied by the standoff between the district's competing governors, were far from the only ones looking to make arrangements. In fact, from Washington's list of the 27 most wanted Taliban, a majority attempted to engineer similar deals. Mullah Abdul Jalil, the deputy foreign minister and one of Mullah Omar's trusted advisors, drew up a settlement with Uruzgan elders. Top Taliban military commander Mullah Kaher surrendered his weapons and pledged support for the new administration. Former Taliban spokesman Abdul Hai Mutmain reached an agreement with Kandahari tribal elders, and so on down the line. No sooner had the olive branch been extended, however, than it was withdrawn. When news of Sherzai's deal with Obaidullah and his comrades surfaced, U.S. officials were furious. Responding to Washington's pressure, Sherzai reversed his position, announcing that all Taliban would be detained and handed over to the Americans. Obaidullah and his company fled to Pakistan. The new Afghan system quickly reorganized around the logic of serving up enemies to the foreign forces, and one attempted pact after another was thwarted. Khairullah Khairqua, for instance, a one-time Taliban interior minister, was a Popalzai tribesman like Karzai and had been friendly with the president's family. In early 2002, he contacted representatives of Ahmed Wali, the president's brother, in the hopes of securing amnesty and perhaps landing a post with the Karzai administration, and the two sides met in a safe house in the Pakistani border town of Chaman. But Pakistani authorities caught wind of his presence, arrested him, and turned him over to the Americans. He was sent to Guantanamo. Ex-Taliban governor Naeem Kuchi was a leader of the Kuchis, Pashtun nomads who number in the millions and crisscross the country with the season. In 2002, he sided with the Karzai administration and functioned as an access broker for his people. He was en route to a meeting with government officials one day when he was detained by American soldiers, sparking bitter demonstrations across Kabul. He too was shipped to Guantanamo. Mullah Abdul Razak, the Taliban minister of commerce, had surrendered to Afghan authorities and retired from political life. Nonetheless, he was arrested by U.S. forces, on Sherzai's suggestion, and dispatched Guantanamo ward as well, even though a subsequent military assessment determined that there was insufficient evidence to connect detainee to any kind of involvement with the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Razak also faced accusations of being a leader of the Taliban movement in exile. In fact, the Americans had confused him with the similarly named Abdul Razak, a former interior minister who indeed was active in the movement. But that Razak, in fact, had also initially sought to reconcile, fleeing to Pakistan, only after he was nearly arrested for his efforts. From there he had attempted to broker a deal directly with the CIA, but in this too he was unsuccessful. By the summer of 2002, nearly the entire senior Taliban had sought refuge in Pakistan, leaving behind only mid-level figures lacking clout in the organization. Occasionally, there would be talk of returning home, but the plight of many junior comrades inside the country loomed large over the deliberations. There was, for instance, the case of Mullah Ahmed Shah. When Sherzai's intelligence agents had come for him, Ahmed Shah was living quietly in his home village in Kandahar, having surrendered his arsenal and retired from life as a minor Taliban commander. Nonetheless, he was accused of harboring weapons. When none were found, he was hauled off to a secret jail in Kandahar City anyway. There, Shah found himself in an underground cell crammed with farmers, tribal elders, and ex-Taliban figures, none of whom who had seen the light of day for weeks. Despite his Taliban past, Shah was so widely respected in his community for his skills as an arbitrator, the tribal elders mobilized for his release. "We met the prisoners in jail and saw that their feet were swollen," Elder Fazal Muhammad recalled. "Their hands and feet had been tied for days. They also beat them with cables. They were begging us to tell the guards to just kill them so that they could be put out of their misery." Shah was told that if he couldn't produce weapons, he would never step outdoors again, so desperate family members resorted to purchasing arms on the black market. A week after being released, though, he was thrown into the same dungeon on the same charges. By now, everyone understood the game, bribes, so the family pawned their livestock to raise funds for his freedom. As with Sherzai's egg, however, once cracked, you were marked for life. Within weeks, Shah was dragged out of his home yet again. This time, his liberty proved too expensive for his penniless family, so tribal elders demonstrated until their protests were heard all the way in Kabul. Shah was let out, but he had been back home for only a few weeks when he caught wind of rumors they were coming for him yet again. Broken and fearful, he collected his family and fled to Pakistan, where he rekindled contacts with his old comrades. The Taliban, he realized, was where he belonged. Not far from Ahmed Shah's village stands the simple mud house of Fata Muhammad, a former schoolteacher and popular Taliban commander. In 2002, like Shah, he surrendered his weapons and retired to his home to become a respected tribal elder in the community. Not long after, he was turned over to the Americans by Sherzai's agents. Upon his release, the normally warm and gregarious Mohammed refused to participate in the local village council and rarely left home. An intelligence agent working for the Karzai government, who had maintained a friendship with him, paid Mohammed a visit and tried to coax him out of the house. He was too ashamed to come out and talk to people, the agent told me. Finally, I convinced his son to let me see him. He looked like a disaster. He hadn't been sleeping well. He started to tell his story of how he was humiliated, stripped naked, beaten, and how they put dogs on him when he was in that state. He was crying and asked how he could possibly live in Afghanistan with any dignity. Not long afterward, Mohammed too fled to Pakistan and reconnected with old friends in the Taliban. Across the country, in one village after the next, the story repeated itself. In a way, the mood of retribution should have been expected. After all, the Taliban's human rights record and their sorry attempt at governance inspired no sympathy. The problem was not so much that the Taliban were targeted, but that they were uniquely targeted. The men now allied with the United States harbored similarly deplorable records from the Civil War era, yet their crimes went unpunished. A true reconciliation process would have required either bringing to justice people from across the entire political spectrum, or else pardoning them all. To the Taliban, justice unequally applied felt like no justice at all. For the top Taliban leadership, the apparent inequity of a war forced upon us, as Mullah Ubaydullah put it, was so great that there seemed no choice but to organize some sort of resistance. Yet, as they regrouped in the Pakistani city of Quetta, there was widespread disagreement about whether anything could actually be done. In late 2002, the leadership met in Karachi and voted in favor of a last-ditch effort to come to an accord with Kabul. Emissaries were sent to meet Karzai's representatives. But with reconciliation still a toxic idea in Washington and in Northern Alliance circles, the effort fizzled. The course now seemed set. Mullah Omar organized a group of about a dozen top Talibs, almost all of whom had attempted to reconcile, as a new leadership body that came to be known as the Quetta Shura. Mullah Ubaydullah took on the task of resurrecting dormant Taliban networks in Afghanistan. He and others reached out to communities in places like John Muhammad's Uruzgan and Sherzai's Kandahar, where resentment was steadily building over the killings, the night raids, the abductions, the torture, the broken alliances, and the fractured hopes. In these communities, the American presence was coming to be seen as an occupation, and Karzai's government increasingly regarded as Washington's venal and vicious puppet. From this point on, there would be no turning back. In Wardak province, the defining event of those days was the defection of Ghulam Muhammad. A hulking man with a shrubby black beard, Muhammad had been a key Taliban provincial commander and an important tribal elder. Akbar Gul had long admired his family, and now that Muhammad was joining Kabul's side, he hoped that government jobs might open up for people like him. In 2003, Muhammad's brother Musa Hotak, who had also been a Talib, was elected as one of the delegates to draft Afghanistan's new constitution. The following year, the two brothers handed over their remaining weapons in a well-publicized ceremony attended by U.S. forces, UN representatives, and the media. Unsurprisingly, the move upset the balance of local politics, pushing Northern Alliance figures to view Ghulam Muhammad as a rival. You can undoubtedly guess what happened next. They fed the usual false intelligence to the Americans, who raided Muhammad's home in July 2004, a mere 2 months after his weapons surrender. "I still get flashbacks," Musa Hotak recalled to a reporter. "They broke down doors, smashed every window. I was clubbed and bitten by dogs. My son and nephews were hooded and shackled. My aged father was dragged out. No human being would do the things those animals did." Ghulam Muhammad was taken to Bagram prison. When Akbar Gul heard the news, he simply could not understand why the Americans would do such a thing to their own ally. He started to wonder aloud whether the foreigners were in fact bent on colonizing us, like the British. That summer, A police truck drove up to his cell phone stall. Two officers got out with drawn Kalashnikovs and ordered Akbargul to lie flat on the dirt. He was kicked in the head and jabbed in the small of his back, and he could hear them rummaging through his stall. As he was forced into the back of the jeep, the policeman informed him that he was in arrears on his car payments and that there was no bribe or elder that could save him. The jeep headed down the open highway in the direction of Kabul. An officer turned and looked at him.
"When we get there," he said, "we'll put heavy stones on your back. We'll keep adding them until you pay what you owe."
When Akbargul protested that he owed nothing, they jabbed him again with their rifles. The jeep drove on, and the policemen wagered among themselves how many stones it would take to break him. It was then that he blurted out that he had savings. The jeep turned around. When they arrived at his home, Akbargul went into a closet, fishing out a small cash box, and returned to show it to them. The men helped themselves and then said he was free to leave. He went back to his shop in the afternoon, 2 years' worth of labor gone. He worked diligently that summer, long into the night, fixing phones and radios. He traveled to other districts for business. He had not made up even a fraction of his savings by autumn, but he had money to eat, and that was enough. Then, one day, he saw the police truck driving up the street, sending him indoors into a friend's shop. Through the window slats, he watched as the policemen approached his stall. They milled around it, talking to each other, gesturing at the cell phones. One reached over and collected them and his tools. Then another raised a foot and kicked the stall hard. A third took his turn. Blow by blow they continued, until only wood shards were left. They returned to their vehicle and drove away. Akbargul stood staring for a long while. A fellow shopkeeper came to console him, but Akbargul did not say anything. After some time, he went home. Akbargul knew certain things. That Afghanistan wasn't a normal country. That to survive, you should expect to exert yourself harder than anywhere else he could imagine. And that even then, everything could vanish in a moment. He had gone from fearing the new order to embracing it. That, he understood, was how history moved. All ideas had their time. Whatever life had been like before, under the new order, everything would be different. "I believed it," he said. "No one could have convinced me otherwise. I believed it in my heart." Now he realized that things were different, but in all the wrong ways. Whenever he turned on the radio, it was all hope and anticipation. But more and more, that seemed like a cruel joke. The truth was, something appeared to be happening right there, in Chak District of Wardak Province. He noticed it in the way that people spoke about the future, about their children. Everyone seemed to be waiting for some sign that change of another sort was on its way. To Akbargul, there could be only one explanation for what the Americans had wrought. They were the world's sole superpower, capable of toppling the Taliban government in 2 months with their fantastically sophisticated technology. If they were now siding with the Northern Alliance, arresting the wrong people, unleashing a predatory police force on his people, it could not have been by accident. No, he reasoned, it was by design. In the mosque on Friday, he would listen to sermons explaining that the Americans were bent on colonizing his country and converting the whole population to Christianity, just as the Russians had attempted to enforce communism. One day, Akbargul received another phone call from Abbas.
"Business is good," he said. "We've been back to work. What about you? What do you think?"
This time the answer seemed obvious. Or, as he explained to me years later, the answer had already been decided for him. And so it was that on that winter day in early 2005, Akbargul decided it was time to go back to work.